Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
G'day, Angus Furley here, filling in for Warwick Long. Coming up on the Country Hour, breaking news on the spread of foot and mouth disease in Asia. Also, a potential AdBlue shortage is again on the horizon as Incitec Pivot prepares to close its Gibson Island manufacturing facility. And you'll hear just how wet it's been in central New South Wales and what that's meant for those farmers trying to get the crop in. You can text in 0467 842 722 or give me a call on 1300 594 222. First up today, rural news with Emma Field.
Good afternoon, Angus. Making news. Indonesian authorities have confirmed that foot and mouth disease has now spread to Bali, with at least 60 cows testing positive to the deadly disease over the weekend. It's understood the disease has been found at three locations across the Indonesian island of Bali. ABC Rural has been told all the infected areas are frequented by many tourists, so the danger of transmission to Australia is much greater than before. There will be more on this breaking news story on tomorrow's Country Hour. The New South Wales government says a natural disaster declaration is imminent as heavy rain continues to lash parts of the state. 71 evacuation orders are in place, with residents northwest of Sydney asked to leave their homes. And farming communities have again been hit by the wet conditions. Southwest of Sydney, near Camden, landowners are facing their fourth flood this year. Kevin Shaw, who lives in the region, says the La Nina weather conditions are wearing them down.
Mentally and physically, it is taxing. If you weren't a strong person, you couldn't do it. Yeah, you've got to be strong to be able to do it, yeah.
There's also flooding across in the Hawkesbury and Nepean River regions. Locals say it's the worst conditions since 1988. Meanwhile, in the Wallandilly Shire, which includes the Central Tablelands, Mayor Matt Gold says farmers are struggling.
A lot of our agricultural producers along the Nepean have had a really rough time the last couple of months just trying to get crops and things in, and those that have been able to get crops in may have just lost them all. It's also, you know, quite a challenge for a number of our villages.
Meanwhile, farmers in New South Wales' central west cropping areas say they could have lost hundreds of thousands of dollars from lost plantings and ruined crops from the record rainfall. And still in New South Wales, the State Department of Primary Industries on Sunday announced it had detected three additional locations at Tanilba Bay, Salt Ash and Mayfield West infested with the invasive varroa mite. An emergency zone for honeybees affected by varroa has been extended to Port Stephens in the New South Wales Hunter region. It follows infestations at the Port of Newcastle, Bundla, Deela and Calgar on the central coast. All honeybee colonies and hives within a 10-kilometre radius of the new sites will be eradicated. Due to flood conditions in New South Wales, a permit has been issued to allow beekeepers in flood watch regions to move hives to a higher location on the same premises. Until the varroa mite is contained, all beehives across New South Wales are at a standstill and cannot be moved. There is also a ban on beehives and products being moved into Victoria from New South Wales. And New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern starts a trade mission to Melbourne today with her agriculture minister in tow. Labour shortages, supply chain disruption and climate change are expected to be among the key topics discussed. There will be 30 people in the delegation led by the Prime Minister, including the Kiora Honey Company. Australia is New Zealand's largest honey export market. And the visit comes after a trademark victory in December last year by the Australian Manuka Honey Association over its New Zealand counterparts. And truffles are back in demand after a dip in demand over the past 2 years due to the pandemic. The peak of the truffle season is about to start in Tasmania, where Ina Unsman farms at Lower Barrington. She says the weather has been ideal this year for truffle growing and demand is up.
We've seen actually the demand growing a lot in the past few years. Obviously with COVID there was a bit of a halt there for a while with restaurants closing. But generally speaking, truffle is getting more and more popular even just with normal people. It used to be seen as this, you know, fine dining ingredient that you can't afford and you wouldn't know what to do with anyway. But thanks to, I think, shows like, you know, MasterChef and all those cooking shows, people are starting to actually learn what to do with truffle and realize that they can use them in their home cooking, and they can be quite affordable depending on where you buy and what you buy. So local people, not even restaurants, but just local people coming in throughout the season and regularly coming and buying a small truffle for their omelette in the morning, or, you know, their breakfast or a nice pasta dinner.
And for Monday, Angus, that's Rural News.
Thanks, Emma. And as you heard there up front from Emma, over the weekend it has been confirmed that foot and mouth disease has spread to barley, with at least 60 cows testing positive to the disease. Dr. Ross Ainsworth is a vet based in Bali. He says the chances of the disease getting into Australia and threatening the nation's red meat sector has just gone up dramatically. He spoke to Matt Brand a short time ago.
Well, it was reported in the press here on Saturday morning that the government had notified that they had confirmed through laboratory testing that 60-odd animals had been found to be infected in districts, three districts to the north and east of Denpasar, and one on the north coast up near Singaraja. So essentially in the tourist, right in the tourist area. So pretty important stuff. Now, the fact that that confirmation was from laboratory testing would suggest that the testing would have been done, say, a week ago. And so, you know, this is, and if they were testing then, well, they probably had infection maybe a week before that. So it could have been here for a fortnight or longer. So it's pretty serious.
This disease has been spreading for a few months now. Why is this update of importance, though, that it's got to barley?
Oh, well, from my perspective, where it has mainly been having its worst effects in Sumatra and Java, there aren't that many Australian tourists. It's a local problem with their livestock. But here in Bali, the chances of tourists coming in contact with cattle is extremely high, and then they potentially are going to jump on the plane and go home. So the chances of the disease being transmitted back to Australia have just gone up dramatically.
A few weeks ago, you wrote that, in your opinion, the risk of FMD getting to Australia is extremely high over the next 1 to 6 months. You really think it could get here this year?
Well, if it's going to come at all, it'll be coming soon. So the situation is that elsewhere in Asia, there's plenty of foot and mouth disease circulating around, but their herds are vaccinated. So the amount of virus that are being shed from animals is pretty small, because vaccinated animals, you know, they don't, not many shed lots of virus. So the important time is the window between the arrival of infection and then the arrival of full vaccinated status. So that's going to take maybe 6 months. It might take even 12 months to get that done in Bali, because they've got pigs here as well. So the rest of Java and most of the rest of Indonesia has hardly any pigs, because it's largely a Muslim country. But Bali is a Hindu religion, and there's lots of pigs here. So pigs multiply the virus much more. Something like 3,000 times more virus comes out of an infected pig than out of an infected cow. So they're just little virus factories. Not that there are that many pigs that would be near any tourists, but they still will be there helping to spread the disease and the virus around the countryside where there are many cattle, and that's where the tourists come in contact. So the danger period here in Bali is from now until the herd is fully vaccinated. So, you know, hopefully it'll be 6 months, but it might be 12.
You're in Bali. Are you seeing or hearing about the vaccination rollout in that area?
Short answer, no. The official picture, I've got it here right in front of me. On the 23rd of June, 2,000 doses were sent to Bali. That's it. The official figures, which are probably roughly correct, there's 600,000 cattle in Bali and 700,000 pigs. So 2,000 doses of vaccine are not much help at the moment.
If you were in charge of Australia's borders, what would you do next?
Yeah, so I would like to see a foot bath at the minimum, you know, a sponge foot bath for people walking onto the plane here in Bali and then walking off in Darwin, or anywhere in Australia, just to make sure that if they've been to Bali and potentially walked past somewhere where a cow had dropped some virus onto the road or the footpath, then that would give us a bit of protection, and also some more, perhaps more careful questioning about who's been on a farm. So the cattle are in the tourist area. The tourists have a good chance of coming across cattle. And this is the most, foot and mouth disease is one of the most infectious diseases known to man.
That was Dr. Ross Ainsworth, a vet based in Bali, speaking with Matt Brann. And what do you think of his suggestion there that at the very least there need to be foot baths installed at airports so that all tourists returning from Indonesia during this high-risk period pass through those foot baths? You can text in 0467 842 722.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Going now from a serious threat to the livestock industry to what's having a big impact on the bee industry. Backyard beekeepers are being urged to check their hives for Varroa destructor mites as hotspots spread on the New South Wales east coast. Four additional infested premises have been detected north of Sydney. All infested premises identified so far are linked to earlier cases. Last week, Queensland, Victoria and South Australia all banned New South Wales bees, and the president of the Victorian Recreational Beekeeping Association, Matt Lamazzi, says biosecurity requirements for backyard beekeepers in Victoria have been bolstered in the past few years.
This is our doomsday event that we have all been possibly expecting in the back of our minds and hopefully all been preparing for. It affects all beekeepers, commercial or recreational. It doesn't discriminate. And the stress is incredible for everyone in the industry or hobby. Recreational beekeepers will feel more emotionally attached potentially to their hives and may cause even more emotional stress than sometimes a commercial beekeeper who faces financial stress. Both of them will affect the beekeeper in similar ways. Basically, I think when we have an event like this make it to land, I think it just becomes a beekeeper event. I don't think it discriminates against recreational or commercial beekeepers.
This conversation does sort of remind me of conversations I've had with horticultural growers in regards to fruit flies. And commercial growers sometimes do show some frustration towards people growing fruit in their backyards, for example, because they're not aware of how sensitive the issue is of biosecurity. Is there a similar situation in beekeeping? Are most backyard beekeepers pretty aware of their obligations?
Most registered beekeepers are aware of their obligations. There are some beekeepers that still don't acknowledge that you legally need to be registered, and that is the best way of staying informed of what is going on in the industry. And I can absolutely understand that would frustrate a commercial operator whose whole livelihood is based on the health of the bees and stopping something like this. On the other hand, there has been some evidence in the past in other countries is recreational beekeepers are sometimes more hands-on and intimate with a small number of hives and have in the past picked up issues earlier than a commercial operator who is going through bulk hives. So there's pros and cons of both, of course, and that's why we just need to work together not leave it up to commercial people to carry the burden and not let the recreational people carry the burden, that we do this together. I think one of the biggest concerns that could arise is someone may be unwilling to let their hives be destroyed as per the protocol in the hot zone. If that were to happen and all those hives are being destroyed and one person goes and removes a hive to take it to somewhere else to save it from eradication, they can potentially be taking those mites with them unknowing, because they, you know, they can hide quite easily in drone cells and things like that.
So what are some of the obligations for smaller beekeepers as far as their day-to-day biosecurity requirements?
So we have a disease and parasite check obligation in our hives throughout the year. And so most beekeepers who have done a course or some sort of training via one of the clubs will understand those obligations and also have been shown how to do the alcohol wash or sugar shake test to detect the varroa, and possibly should have been practicing that throughout the year or doing drone uncapping to check for that. And so at the minute, being winter in Victoria, most of our hives would have been packed down and left until the spring. And so the department's latest advice is to get in the hive if the weather allows for it. So if we get a mild day with very little wind and the sun is shining, there's an opportunity maybe to open the hive up, have a look in, and possibly do that sugar shake test really early on this season. And just making sure that you're... The other thing is keeping logs of what you find. If you see something suspicious, you see something in the hive that's not meant to be, going back to, you know, there's a lot of information from the department online, and you can identify what you may have found. And there are a few things which are mandatory reporting to the apiary officers.
Victorian Recreational Beekeepers Association has created an online form where people can alert the agriculture department about feral or unmanaged hives. What can you tell us about that?
So this is something we've done in response to this outbreak. What we understand is one of the biggest challenging factors in these instances, and when we had a scare in Melbourne Port a few years ago, it was not knowing where the hives were located of a registered beekeeper. So a registered beekeeper may live in the CBD, but generally would maybe not keep their hives with them in the CBD. So where they're registered and where their hives are two different things. And it led us to understand that it's knowing where the bees are is more important than where the registered beekeeper's home address is. And the Agriculture Victoria keeps the database of registered beekeepers. What we don't know is unmanaged hives. We refer to a wild colony as a feral colony. So what we want to know is, even the general public walking around, noticing a wild colony of bees in a tree, in a possum box, anything like that, we just want to know where it is so we can start to log that if there was ever an incident like we've seen in New South Wales come to Victoria or into Melbourne. We would then have a bit of an additional data set that we can provide to AgVic for them to then overlay with hive locations. And we can know if they're going into an area and they need to know what bees are there, we can say we've got an additional 10 or 20 hives that we know of in trees, in parks, you know, irrigation boxes, possum boxes.
That was President of the Victorian Recreational Beekeeping Association, Matt Lamazzi, speaking with Jane McNaughton. And if you know of a feral bee colony and you'd like to report it, you can head to beewatch.com.au or you can contact Agriculture Victoria. Now, on the text line, I asked whether people supported that recommendation from Dr. Ross Ainsworth in relation to foot and mouth disease, that all tourists returning from Indonesia should pass through a foot bath to wash their shoes. Well, Robin Bunbartha says, yes, a foot bath is a good idea, but what about dirty footwear in someone's luggage? Good point, Rob. And that text line, 0467 842 722.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, farmers in central west New South Wales are facing huge losses after record rainfall has prevented them from planting substantial portions of their cropping areas. Hamish Cole spoke with a number of farmers from the Forbes and Parks areas about how they're coping.
Barber farms wheat and canola near Parkes, and like many in the Central West, he has only planted 50% of his crop. So far this year, he has received 450 mils of rain, leaving his paddocks too wet to drive machinery on, therefore preventing him from sowing on large parts of the farm.
The biggest probably issue we face out of that is the carrying capacity of the ground, so obviously trying to get our machinery to come across to start our planting window. But mate, that's probably the worst issue we've got now is with the rainfall, obviously the weed control and the ground carrying capacity, yeah. But the main one is, mate, canola, putting our canola in a certain window. There's about a 3 to 4 week, mainly 3 week period there where we can put that in. And unfortunately with that rain event, continuous rain event means most of us have missed that, and some of us that have actually been able to get the canola in have put it in and then had a bigger rain event on it and the seed's been burst, which requires a lot of re-sowing and then again re-sowing at a later stage. So things aren't all that flash for that sowing window of canola. And then with the wheat varieties of the cereals, again, different large rain events have quite hampered that issue of carrying, again, machines being able to be carried on the ground. And again, a lot of guys haven't set up for a late variety of sowing wheat. So yeah, an early maturing wheat has been an issue there.
It's a similar story for Forbes farmer Neil Kingham.
It's totally disrupted all of those sowing windows all closed about a month ago now. So we're in uncharted territories. The canola that we sowed in April unfortunately drowned, because instead of getting the 10 to 20 mil forecast, we got 90 mil, and that just laid in the paddocks and drowned the seeds. So we find ourselves at the end of June basically starting from scratch.
With record prices for canola and wheat, this year was supposed to be an opportunity for farmers to recoup the losses experienced during the drought. However, now there are concerns farmers will be pushed to a breaking point.
It does, mate. It takes an impact. Like a lot of things, you know, with the price of fuel and the availability of fertilisers and things like that, this, and also the price of commodities here now, it's an opportunity for us to actually cement ourselves to continue growing in this area. You know, it's an opportunity for us to make some good money and to make a decent return on what we're doing, you know, to support that loss that we had in 2018 and 19 during the drought. It's very draining to see the price of wheat and the price of canola where it is and not be able to get onto the land to plant it. It takes its toll. Like it's really difficult and frustrating, and you've got to be able to sort of step away from that if you can and be easy on yourself, I think, during years, especially like this year, where there is an option to make a good living and a good wage, but not being able to it's pretty much like going to work. You know, if you're going to work a $200,000 a year job but you can't get to work because your car broke down or, you know, something insignificant like that, it's hampering you from making a good living and recovering some of those costs that we delve into to survive 2018, 2019 during the drought.
The conditions seen across the region, combined with growing uncertainty on the international market, is part of an industry growing more and more volatile.
This is a new age for us here at the moment. Anything being so volatile, the weather being so volatile, you know, we've never seen this much rain here at the start of this year or at the start of any year, really. Back when he was there, it was sort of a month to a year sort of forecast. You could see that coming, whereas now in my generation, it's days and weeks, and you just can't run a business with that sort of forecast. Like it's nearly physically impossible, you know, having a long growing period with wheat and then obviously with the sheep as well to try and restock, and the price again as well, that's another thing too. So the volatility, obviously, with the Russia and Ukraine scenario there, no one seems to know. Oil, that's the other issue. You can't forecast that sort of stuff. You can't forecast the price of urea and fertiliser, the availability, COVID as well. Like, there's so many variables in this sort of thing, and it just makes that forecasting and that risk a lot more difficult to try and to take on and to spread out.
Recently, the Bureau of Meteorology declared La Nina, the weather pattern that has brought heavy rainfall to much of the state, has ended. It's brought renewed hope that the harvest could be saved with drier conditions.
So we need a period of probably a month of dry weather to be able to sow the paddocks that are already waterlogged and give them a chance to dry out. From there, we need cool conditions with regular rainfall, but not too much rainfall. So at this point, we're starting to get quite picky, and it would need to be a harvest, you know, after Christmas, effectively, to give enough growing time for the varieties to do what they need to do.
For now, though, these farmers are just rushing to get what they can in the ground before it's too late.
That was Hamish Cole with that report on the impact that rainfall is having on Central West farmers and their cropping plans. And there is a story up now on the ABC Rural website, abc.net.au/rural. Well, it's just gone 12:30, so let's get off to news headlines now today with Beck Simmons.
Good afternoon, Angus. Making news, a 53-year-old man faced Horsham Magistrates Court today over a three-car collision in Victoria's West last year, which claimed the lives of two elderly women. A cement truck collided with an SUV in Horsham last October, causing it to hit a ute. Two women, aged 79 and 78, died in the crash, while three others were injured. The 53-year-old driver of the cement truck has been charged with dangerous driving causing death and serious injury. He was bailed to appear at a committal mention in September. Swan Hill police are investigating the racist graffiti found last week on a sign outside Sea Lake. The graffiti on a Welcome to Country sign at Sea Lake Robinvale Road has since been removed. Police say there is no place in society for hate-based behaviour and they take such reports seriously. More Bendigo-built military vehicles will be sent to Ukraine, with the Prime Minister announcing it will fund 20 Bushmasters as part of a $100 million military aid boost. Federal Labor member Lisa Chesters says this will be the third shipment of the armoured four-wheel drives, which are also being sent to flood-hit areas in New South Wales. Police are calling for witnesses to a crash at Coowee Rup in Victoria's East yesterday morning. Emergency services responded to reports of a crashed motorcycle on Rossiter Road just after 7:30 a.m. The motorcyclist died at the scene. Anyone who saw the crash or people with dashcam vision are being asked to contact Crime Stoppers on 1800 333 000. Doctors are slamming the Medicare benefits schedule indexation increase as insufficient and unlikely to make any difference for GPs battling rising medical costs and increasing patient demand. There are also calls for the government to better fund telehealth after the Medicare rebate for telephone consults was cut. The Royal Australian College of General Practitioners spokesperson Dr. Charlotte Hespy says a lack of investment in primary health care is a long-term problem that urgently needs to be addressed. Victoria's Shadow Roads Minister is calling for the state government to provide greater transparency on the timeline for the Western Highway Duplication Project. Major Road Projects Victoria announced last week it will prepare a cultural heritage management plan for the section between Buangor and Ararat after a Supreme Court fight to protect trees along the road was dropped. Steph Ryan says it remains unclear how long the plan will take and the community deserves to be updated. For more news at any time, visit abc.net.au/news.
Thanks, Beck. Beck Simmons there with news headlines.
On ABC Radio Victoria, this is the Victorian Country Hour.
Well, let's head off to the Weather Bureau now, where Senior Forecaster Mark Danilak is on duty. Good afternoon, Mark.
G'day, Angus. How are you going?
Well, I'm warming up now, Mark, but a pretty frosty start to the day. Again in Horsham this morning after a frost yesterday as well, I think.
It's been very cold last few nights, actually, and clear skies through particularly northern parts of the state has given very, very cold nights. So even this morning, we saw temperatures getting below zero right across northern and western parts of the state. Of note, Wangaratta, who's had sort of negative two and a half the last couple of days, this morning had negative 4 degrees, so very cold. Even in Horsham, got down to minus one degree. So, very cold conditions across the weekend and even this morning. Looking at the current situation, we have a high pressure system still hovering south of the Bight, south of South Australia, and that low pressure system that caused plenty of problems for New South Wales is over the Tasman Sea. The combination of those two systems delivering a cool southeasterly wind regime across Victoria. And as such, we're seeing some cloud about southern parts of the state banking up against the ranges. But even now, that cloud is starting to really break up, and we're seeing some significant areas of clear skies across the state. Gippsland at this stage, the clouds a little bit thicker, and they could see a light shower here and there. But probably falls of 2 to 7 millimetres in the next 24 hours for East Gippsland before that clears up tomorrow afternoon. But for the rest of the state, fine conditions are forecast, even though there might be a little bit of cloud around the south. Tomorrow morning, we can expect another cold morning. The pressure pattern's not changing. We're not seeing any change to the system, so I expect we'll see very similar conditions tomorrow. So a very frosty morning again tomorrow, and one can expect a frost warning out for parts of the state tomorrow. Keep an eye on that for this afternoon. And Wednesday morning looks like the coldest morning of the next few. So we'll see temperatures getting below zero again through much of the state on Wednesday morning. The days themselves, as I said, a little bit of shower activity probably for eastern parts of the eastern tip of Victoria tomorrow morning, but otherwise we're looking at fine conditions through much of the state tomorrow and into Wednesday, pretty much fine right across the whole state on Wednesday. Very late Wednesday night, we'll see a weakening trough move into the southwest of the state. We're likely to see increase in shower activity about the southwest in the very early hours of Thursday morning. And those showers will continue across the southeast district into central districts during Thursday morning. They may even reach across to Gippsland, but the system is weakening as it moves eastwards. So while there's a slight risk of showers over sort of west and south Gippsland, I don't think there'll be much in it by the time that system gets across to Gippsland on Thursday afternoon. As we move into Friday and the weekend, another high-pressure system will drift in from the west, and we'll see a return to fine conditions, but very cold nights again for the weekend. So I guess the story of this week is cold conditions continuing through much of the state, with just a bit of a ripple of shower activity drifting across on Thursday for southern parts of the state. We have no warnings out at the moment, Angus, so I think that pretty much wraps it up for me.
Okay, Mark, and I mean, most people would know that the New South Wales east coast at the moment is getting an absolute drenching with that east coast low, bringing huge rainfall to certain areas, particularly in that Sydney area. Does that weather system have any possible impacts on Victoria?
Only for East Gippsland. Thankfully, that system, the most of the rainfall with that system is pretty much staying north of our border. But that southeasterly flow, just on the very, very southern flank of that low pressure system, or that East Coast low, is pushing some shower activity onto East Gippsland. That's what I was sort of talking about before. So up until sort of between now and probably lunchtime tomorrow, they'll still be under the influence of that southern flank of that East Coast low, so another, you know, 2 to 7 millimetres is possible for the eastern tip of Victoria. But really, the worst of it is north of our border, and it looks like it's starting to ease off for them now.
Okay, and elsewhere in the state, it sounds like a pretty dry outlook for the week.
Pretty dry, cool, frosty mornings coming up, and clear skies during the day.
Okay, thanks very much, Mark.
No worries, cheers.
Mark Anilak there, Senior Forecaster at the Weather Bureau. Better have a look at the text line now, because there are quite a few texts coming through on the fact that foot and mouth disease has now been picked up in cattle in Bali for the first time. A texter asks, how long can foot and mouth virus survive on shoes, etc.? Talking about the need for foot baths in airports. Well, I had a look at the Agriculture Victoria website. It says foot and mouth disease may remain infective in the environment for several weeks, and low temperatures and high humidity increases virus survival. So it can endure for quite a while. Kim also says, hi Angus, it's a resounding yes from me for making foot baths mandatory for people arriving from Indonesia. I'm with the experts on this one. Foot and mouth disease is one of the greatest risks to the livestock industry and has far-reaching effects, not just for weeks nor months, but years. ground becomes unusable and therefore devalued. Stock suffers, the family suffers, farmers suffer, as does the general population through higher prices. If it can be stopped at the border, stop it there. I'm a farmer's daughter and a farmer's wife. There have been six generations of farmers on my parents' farm, and it would be sad to see someone else's carelessness ruin that. Thanks for that text, Kim. And Helen, with a similar sentiment, most definitely we need footbaths for people's shoes. Foot and mouth disease would be catastrophic to Australian farming. And Laurie says, good afternoon, Angus. Remember how the COVID virus walked off that cruise ship? It seems like the same thing has happened with the B virus. So that's in relation to varroa mite, which is spreading in New South Wales. And I think it was initially detected a couple of weeks ago in surveillance bees at the port of Newcastle. So that's what Laurie is alluding to there, that it's come in through the ports. That text line, 0467 842 722.
On ABC Radio Victoria, this is the Victorian Country Hour.
Well, farming and transport organisations are worried the nation faces another potential AdBlue shortage. AdBlue is that anti-pollutant that's added to most modern diesel engines, including trucks and some farm machinery. There was a shortage of it late last year when China stopped exporting refined urea, the key ingredient in AdBlue. And in response, the Morrison government gave almost $30 million to Queensland company Incitec Pivot to ramp up its AdBlue manufacturing. That created a short-term fix for supply, but Incitec Pivot is closing that facility at the end of the year. Acting Chief Executive of the National Farmers Federation, Charles Thomas, says a solution is needed urgently.
We'd be horrified to see that domestic production close off without any alternative in place or without any assurance that we're not going to simply revert straight back to the supply issues that we saw late last year. We were extremely pleased when we saw the previous government invest to keep that plant operational and increase its output of AdBlue. And it really now needs some sort of forward thinking from government to think about these next steps beyond the end of this year and what that's going to mean for supply.
Do you have any ideas? What's the solution?
Certainly, I think some increased investment from government. I think it's clear that there are some economic challenges in local production of AdBlue without any level of government assistance. Fortunately, what we've seen from this government is a commitment to invest $500 million from the National Reconstruction Fund into projects specifically related to agriculture. So that could be used to increase domestic urea supply, part of which can be used for AdBlue. And of course, that's part of a larger $15 billion National Reconstruction Fund, which is intended to be used to co-invest in these sorts of, nationally significant economic projects. So that's exactly what we would like this sort of thing to be used for.
And you'd like that invested into onshore manufacturing?
Absolutely. So I think at the moment the government's looking at that allocation for agriculture with a particular focus on value adding of end products, which we think is absolutely important. But what we're saying to government is that we also need to look at some of these critical inputs which make the agriculture sector function. And that's things like AdBlue, but also potentially domestic production of crop protection products, fertilisers. And, you know, these are obviously things where we're also seeing incredible increases in costs for imported products and difficulties in accessing supply at times. So what's needed is really a strategic look at the supply chain vulnerabilities for our entire food system and where government can invest to sort of shore that up, whether it's pre-farm gate inputs, value adding and processing and transport and logistics.
In the case of AdBlue, do you think it's something that needs to be subsidised permanently? Is it profitable to make it onshore in Australia permanently?
Look, I'm sure I'm not 100% across the economics of that, and it's something that I'm sure will change. And, we're seeing an incredible pace of change at the moment as energy markets sort of dictate what can and can't be done in terms of onshore production at the moment. But certainly, what's important is that we have access to supply. So whether that's coming from a local source or internationally, we need to be 100% confident that that can't be disrupted easily, that we've got resilience in that supply chain. And if that means that it needs to be produced locally, then that's obviously where we'll have to go.
That was Acting Chief Executive of the National Farmers Federation, Charles Thomas, speaking with Lucinda Jose. Just about to go 12:45. You're listening to The Country Hour with Angus Firley. And July 4 is regarded as the number one grilling holiday in the United States. And this year, Australian lamb will be hitting American hot plates in record numbers. The US has become Australia's most valuable overseas market for lamb, with exports rising sharply during the past 2 years to be worth $988 million in 2021. Matt Brand reports.
More than ever before, Americans are sitting down to a good feed of Aussie lamb.
Tender, juicy, great for any dish. Grill it all with Australian lamb.
Lamb from Australia has long been available in the fine dining restaurants of the US, but during the pandemic, Americans locked at home and cooking for themselves got a real taste of lamb, and they found it easy to cook. And so far this year, the US is easily Australia's biggest and most valuable market for lamb exports. It's a great story, according to Bonnie Skinner, the Chief Executive of Sheep Producers Australia.
It's pretty interesting, I guess, with people being locked down. You know, people were, I guess, becoming more adventurous with trying different types of cooking, different cuts of meat, different types of meat. And that's certainly what we saw in the US, lots of people trying lamb out, and it's driven retail sales through the roof, and it's really encouraging to see, of course, from an Australian lamb perspective.
I've got a line here from Thomas Foods USA that during the pandemic, apparently out of all of the major meat protein sold at US supermarkets, it was Aussie lamb that showed the largest growth. Does that surprise even you, Bonnie Skinner?
It did. You know, we I guess particularly around certain times of year, around holidays and that sort of thing, we obviously see turkey coming through, and of course they're big beef eaters as well. But it was surprising to see some of the statistics on it recently. Very happy about it, of course.
What's this mean for Australian sheep producers in terms of their profitability?
Well, I think, you know, obviously export demand is always going to drive profitability for the industry, and that's encouraging, particularly as we're, you know, we still continue to come out of drought, and we're obviously in full swing of a flock rebuild. So it's great that we've got, you know, I guess lambs in the chute, ready to supply to global customers, which of course is going to drive prices. But what we have to make sure that we're also addressing as an industry are the challenges that we've got around processor capacity at the moment in this country, and what impact that's going to have on production as well.
Yeah. Are the abattoirs keeping up for you?
Certainly they're struggling at the moment with processor worker shortages that we know. We've got major issues with our workforce across not just the processing sector but across agriculture generally. And so, yes, some plants are not operating at full capacity, and we know we're gearing up for a spring lamb season. So we've got to do what we can to try and address this issue.
In terms of this US market, what's your hopes on what it might do in the coming 5-10 years?
Well, obviously we'd hope that it would continue to grow. I think what's interesting coming through, and particularly when we see, you know, millennials as a part of these home chefs that have really been experimenting with lamb in the kitchen, you know, continuing awareness of things like provenance, sustainability, welfare, this real paddock to plate story, which is being conveyed through particularly the online selling platforms. I guess that what that means for us is how can we tailor the production that we've got here in Australia and our branding and our messaging to make sure that we're demonstrating what we're doing here in Australia, which is very sustainable, and aligning our practices with that, I guess, what the customers want to see. So I think there's great opportunity for the lamb industry there. We've got a fantastic story to tell, and I think there's lots of ways that we continue to build on that.
That was Bonnie Skinner, Chief Executive of Sheep Producers Australia, speaking with Matt Brand. And you can read more about America's rising appetite for Australian lamb if you head to the ABC Rural website.
You're listening to the Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Last year, two brothers and their dad came together to shear as many lambs as possible in 24 hours. Corey and Brody Mifsud and their dad, Roger, hope to raise awareness of autism and fundraise a few $1,000s for specialist schools in Warrnambool and Stawell. Well, the results of that fundraising are in, and I had a chat with Corey earlier about the extraordinary final tally.
We finalised our tally. It wasn't so long ago. Sort of a lot of small donations coming in, and lucky enough to have a $10,000 donation come in last minute, anonymous donation. So that was huge for us. But we raised just under $80,000. So it was around $78,000 we raised for the event in total.
And how did that tally compare to what you hoped to raise?
Oh, it was absolutely massive. We sort of nowhere near expected to raise that sort of money. We were happy with $5,000, you know. Yeah, just the amount of support and donations that come in from, you know, a lot of businesses in Warrnambool and Stawell and across the southwest, and, you know, a lot of farmers that sort of supported us who we've shorn for over the years and that sort of thing. It was massive to be able to reach that milestone. You know, we're there to raise probably more the awareness than money at the end of the day, but we're really, really happy with that total.
And just for those who might not recall, Corey, talk me through what cause you were raising awareness of and what you were raising money for.
So it all come about, I've got a four-year-old autistic boy, Levi, and it was just more to raise awareness for, as parents, myself and Levi's mother, we'd found it really hard to go out in public and, you know, with Levi having his meltdowns at times when he was younger and getting that judgment from people that probably didn't really understand, they obviously didn't know Levi and his situation, and children and even adults with autistic traits that at times they can't communicate and they tend to, you know, have a meltdown or get frustrated because they can't get what they want across or, you know, communicate with their parents or other people in general. So we were just putting that awareness out there that as parents you sort of don't want people to judge when they don't really know the situation, and that was the driving force was getting that awareness out there. And we just thought we'd approach a couple disability schools, one in Stawell, a Skiing Street School, and Mirai River School here in Warrnambool, to see if they wanted to get behind and accept any support that we could offer.
And Corey, you've started to allocate some of that money that was raised?
Yeah, we have. So we've divided up $23,000 each to the two schools. So yes, Skiing Street received $23,000, and we gave the same monetary value to Mirai River, but they had a labour donation come in to build their walking track down to the river. So that's sort of where we got the $78,000 from.
And I think the Skiing Street School in Stawell is going to put the money toward its basketball courts?
Yeah, so our original plan was just to get a new basketball ring built there for them, because they just had the sort of the backyard kids basketball ring there, and obviously an all ability school, not everyone could use it. So now they're putting it to a few things, actually, a new basketball court with retractable basketball ring that can sort of go different heights for, you know, people, kids in wheelchairs, and, you know, and then, you know, because they range from sort of 4 to 5 years old right up to 18 at the school there. So, you know, they can sort of change it for whoever needed it at the time. And, yeah, they're also building, resurfacing their basketball court and putting it towards a track around their little oval. So they've sort of got a few things out of that.
And, Corey, your son Levi, you mentioned earlier, I assume he's off to school next year. Is he going to go to one of those schools?
Yeah, so we're hoping that he'd be accepted into Stawell at this point. Natalie, she lives in Stawell there, so we're hoping that, yeah, Levi would be accepted to Skiing Street.
Corey, before I let you go, I suppose we're about 7 months or so now on from the shear-a-thon. That was 24 hours of shearing time. I think you saw between yourself, your brother and your dad, you saw close to 3,000 lambs in that time. But how have the three of you reflected back on that? I think it was dubbed sheer madness. How have you reflected back on that madness since then?
Yeah, it was definitely sheer madness. 24-hour shearing time. So essentially, I think our day was, you know, close to 40 hours with our breaks and things like that. But, it was definitely, I feel like we set out to achieve. Well, my goal was to shear 1,000, and I think I shore 1,000 and I can't even think, 42 or something like that. And my goal was to, obviously, to beat Dad. So I achieved both those. I beat Dad and got my 1,000. So we sort of had a little joke here and there about it at times, and Dad and Brody are actually planning another one at some point, but they've asked me to attend, but there's no absolutely no way after doing two of these in the last sort of 3 or 4 years I won't be doing another one. I actually don't shear anymore, so that's how much it affected me. I retired since then, so we sort of sit back and have a joke, and, yeah, it sort of burnt me out a bit, so I've I've pulled the pin on shearing now, but don't regret it. Loved it, and sort of a new chapter for me now.
What are you up to these days, Corey?
So I've taken on a role at Warrnambool South West Healthcare as an Aboriginal liaison officer. So I sort of look after Indigenous patients and their families through the healthcare, through South West Healthcare, just getting out to community, into the Indigenous community through all the organisations here and just supporting and celebrating our culture where we can.
Former Shearer Corey Mifsud there. Off to market starting today at Pakenham Cattle with Brendan Fletcher.
Numbers increased to 770 more with the usual buyers operating in a cheaper market. Quality was limited with wintry cattle throughout. A handful of well-finished trade cattle sold a little dearer. Grown steers and bullocks were in short supply. Manufacturing steers sold from firm to 5 cents easier. Cows eased 5 to 10 cents on most sales, with processors loading cows for an estimated 547 to 742 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy bulls gained a few cents. Vealers sold from 438 to 600 cents. Yearling trade steers 550 to 596. The heifer portion 486 to 598. Grown steers and bullocks 450 to 500 cents. Heavy Frisian manufacturing steers 335 to 381. Crossbreds 361 to 468. Most light and medium weight cows 225 to 355. Heavyweights 262 to 398. Heavy bulls 320 to 360.
Thanks, Brendan. To Wagga Cattle now with Leanne Dax.
Just over 2,000 cattle were offered to a bigger group of feedlot buyers. Quality remains secondary, with very few trade cattle on offer. Heavy export cattle were in reasonable numbers, with most selling to stronger feedlot competition. Veal, 540 to 570. Restocking weaner steers sold to weak competition, falling 60 cents, 475 to 660. Yearling steers, 330 to 400 kilo to feed on, dropped 20 cents, 495 to 590. The medium weight feeder steers eased back 450 to 560. Trade steers, very few to quote, 555 to 560. Feeder heifers, the lighter weights slipped back 5, with the medium weights falling 25, 430 to 530. Trade heifers eased 3, 460 to 530. Heavy kill steers sold 10 cents cheaper, 410 to 485. Heavy feeder steers gained momentum, surging 30 cents, 455 to 522. Bullocks jumped 20 cents to the kill, 420 to 465. Leanne Dax, MLA.
Thanks, Leanne. And Bendigo Lambs now with Jenny Kelly.
Good afternoon. Small yard in of 8,100 lambs and just 1,500 sheep. Quality was very mixed, with some good grain-fed lambs, but a lot of wintry types lacking finish. There wasn't as many big export lambs on offer, partly due to Fletcher's of Dubbo being closed for a couple of weeks and not buying. The better finished lambs from 780 to 860 cents a kilo, and the plainer untidy lot showing a wide range of 650 to 760 cents. 1 pen of extra heavy export lambs at 38 to 40 kilos carcass made $277, with most sales of 30 kilo plus crossbreds from 238 to 265. The heavy 26 to 30 kilo lambs, 200 to 249. A better selection of heavy trades, 24 to 26 kilos, 193 to 214. The best run averaging around 8.20 cents a kilo. Neat trades, 22 to 24 kilos, 187 to 210 at a ballpark cost of 8.30 cents. Underneath this was plainer trade lambs at 155 to 180 and store lambs at 100 to 150 with a bit of frame. Jenny Kelly for MLA.
Thanks, Jenny. And finally today, Mortlake Cattle with Chris Agnew.
Agents sharded 409 cattle at Mortlake, a slight increase of 53 head. The quality overall was better on the better side for the week for a typical winter's yarding. The sale was generally firm to slightly dearer for quality driven for all trade cattle, with cows over most grades also firm to slightly dearer in places. More so on the better end, dairy cows were also 10 cents a kilogram stronger. Vealers with shape sold from 525 to 570. The yearling steers and heifers made between 485 and 580 cents. Grown steers and heifers making between 388 and 498. Manufacturing steers from 324 to 410. And the best beef cows to 380 cents. The general run making between 320 and 378. Dairy cows 255 to 3 to 290. At Mortlake, this is Chris Agnew reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Chris. Well, that's just about it for the Country Hour, and there are texts that I haven't got to on the text line, all along the same lines, very much supportive of the proposal to have mandatory foot baths at the airports for arrivals from Indonesia after foot and mouth disease has now been detected in Bali. Remember the ABC Rural website, abc.net.au/rural, and ABC Rural on Facebook.